It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in Central Time, what happens when your performance goes viral online when performed by someone else without your permission? An Eau Claire couple tells their story.
First, the National Transportation Safety Board wants states to lower the blood alcohol limit for drivers from 0.08 to 0.05.
The recommendation comes as part of the organization's Most Wanted list, where officials lay out a number of ways states can make transportation safety improvements and reduce traffic deaths.
The board says by the time a driver's blood alcohol content reaches 0.08%, the risk of a fatal crash more than doubles.
Critics point out, though, that trying to enforce this 0.05% limit could be difficult, and drunk driving laws can be tough to pass in state legislatures.
For more on these recommendations and other ways other states are trying to reduce drunk driving, we're joined by J.T. Griffin, Chief Government Affairs Officer for Mothers Against Drunk Driving. J.T., thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So why does the National Transportation Safety Board want states to lower the legal blood alcohol content limit?
Well, the NTSB several years ago put out a pretty comprehensive report on drunk driving, and with regard to the 0.05 limit, had looked at several studies in Europe in countries that had lowered the BAC limit to 0.05, and so they took some of their recommendations from some of the things happening overseas.
And what is Mothers Against Drunk Driving's stance on that?
Well, first, our stance on drunk driving is that any time someone decides to go out and drink, we encourage them to plan ahead and make sure to choose a sober, non-drinking designated driver beforehand. So regardless of BAC, it's important that people plan before going out. Our particular stance with regard to 0.05 is that MAD is content with keeping the illegal BAC per se limit at 0.08, which is where it is now, and we would like to see other laws passed that we believe could have a greater impact on reducing drunk driving deaths.
So why are you content to leave it at 0.08?
Well, because we know that with 0.08 versus 0.05, we know that that's the illegal limit where drivers are noticeably drunk on the highway. And we know that at that limit that everyone is impaired. And we also know that the difficulty that goes along with changing these laws, it was only recently that all states, it was I believe in 2004 when all states adopted 0.08. So we know how difficult it is to go back to some of these states and try to lower the BAC. And we believe that our resources are better spent at the State House, passing things like ignition interlocks for all convicted drunk drivers. We believe that those things would have a bigger impact on reducing actual fatality and injury numbers.
So if we look at what might happen if this were to be adopted here in Wisconsin, change from 0.08 legal blood alcohol content to 0.05, in real world sort of drinks, what would that be? A drink for women and a couple for men? What do you think?
Well, it's hard to say exactly what it would be, but I think that with regard to that point, it's important that everybody plan ahead. And, you know, impairment can begin before 0.08, and I think that's something that is important to remember. Impairment can begin with the very first drink. And so that's why it's important to plan ahead in terms of what 0.05 versus 0.08 looks like. It's very dependent on the person. Someone who may weigh more, someone who is a man versus a woman, those types of things all impact how much you've had to eat. Those types of things impact your BAC, and that's why we go back to it's really important to planning ahead. And for people, if you want to have a good time, which Matt is we have no problem with, just making a good decision and a good game plan beforehand.
What do you mean by planning ahead? What would you like people to do?
Well, if you're going to go out and you're going to, and you're over 21, of course, and you're going to consume an alcoholic beverage or beverages, designate a driver beforehand who's not drinking, who can make sure everybody gets home safely, or take things like public transit. There are plenty of new apps out there like Uber and Lyft, which allow people to get a ride home. So all of those types of things give people plenty of choices and plenty of ways to get home without driving drunk. Regardless of BAC limit, it's important that we keep people safe.
We're talking to J.T. Griffin right now from Mothers Against Drunk Driving, talking about recent recommendations that states lower the legal blood alcohol content limit from 0.08 to 0.05. And getting back to a route through the legislature in this particular scenario, do you think that the federal government could provide money for highways in order to motivate states to pass a law like this?
I think that's very difficult to do at this stage. MAD worked very, very hard to pass the national 0.08 standard. That passed in 1999 as part of an omnibus appropriations bill. To do something like that today would just be very, very challenging. I think one of the things to remember is that at the time in 1999 when that 0.08 standard passed, there were many states that were that had a BAC per se limit that was higher than 0.08. So it wasn't until federal standards went into place that all states did this. And so I think it would be, given the current situation in the Congress, at the national level, I think it would be very difficult to either find more money to incentivize states or to take money away from states which failed to do that.
Would you expect to see any kind of backlash from drivers if the legal limit is reduced to 0.05?
Well, I'm not so sure about drivers as much. I think most people, know at this point in time that it's not a good idea to drink and drive. I do think you could have a backlash from the alcohol industry, from the Tavern League, from restaurants. I do think that they would be upset with such a proposal. In fact, I know that they would. So that's one of the reasons that I think it, from a legislative perspective, it would be very difficult to lower the BAC.
So if you didn't think it would have a difficult route through the legislature lowering the limit to 0.05, would you be supportive of that? Or do you, on a general principle, think that things like ignition interlock systems just work better?
Well, you know, we think that ignition interlock systems just work better. We have seen, and we're trying to pass a law in Wisconsin right now, which would require if someone gets a DUI that they get an interlock. We've seen DUI fatality reductions of 30, 40, in a state like Arizona, 50%. And fatality reductions of that magnitude are almost unheard of in traffic safety, save for inventions like the seatbelt. So things like ignition interlocks, which actually require a convicted drunk driver to breathe into the device before starting his or her vehicle, things like that are proven to reduce fatalities in a big way. 0.05, while you can argue the level of impairment, we've looked at MAD, we've looked at the studies, and we haven't seen whereby they would have fatality reductions near that level. And so while I think my friends at the NTSB are trying to put out some good recommendations, from MAD's perspective, the best use of everyone's time is to focus on these ignition interlock laws right now, and we think we can save the most lives that way.
Now that we do have these new recommendations out, though, from the National Transportation Safety Board, what do you think happens next?
I have seen very little movement in the states to pass a 0.05 law. And so I think from MAD's perspective, I think we're going to continue to try and pass these ignition interlock laws. We've had huge success over the past 10 years since we've been doing this. In 2006, we started with one state, which was New Mexico, that required interlocks for all drunk drivers. Today, we're up to 25, having passed Texas in 2015. So we're very excited about the work that we're doing. We feel like at MAD, we have an actual blueprint to eliminate drunk driving in America. Part of that is through the ignition interlocks, if we can get all states to adopt that. Part of it is through a program called the DADS program, which is the Driver Alcohol Detection System for Safety. That's a ongoing project between the federal government and car manufacturers to try and develop a passive system to go in the vehicle that could detect whether a driver was above the illegal limit of 0.08. And if it were, it would make the car inoperable. So we feel like at MAD, we have a blueprint to eliminate drunk driving in America, and we're going to focus on those countermeasures, which we know are proven to work and have a big impact.
JT, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was JT Griffin from Mothers Against Drunk Driving talking about recent recommendations that states lower the legal blood alcohol content limit from 0.08 to 0.05. Wisconsin-based comedian and juggler Kobe Shaw made a splash 2 years ago when her video was played on The Ellen Show. Here she is playing the Carol of the Bells on a suit of bells attached to her clothing.
Kobe Shaw in Colfax, Wisconsin.
Hi, Ellen. This one's for you.
In December of last year, her performance went viral on YouTube with over 15 million hits in a 3-day span. Good news! Except, bad news, it wasn't her. It was somebody else doing the exact same act she had done on TV.
That's kicked off an online effort to protect intellectual property in the Wild West that is the Internet. Kobe Shaw joins us now along with her husband and onstage partner Steve Russell. They are jugglers and comedians based in Colfax. Kobe and Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Well, Kobe, start us off by telling us what it was like when you first realized that this act you had come up with had gotten famous, gone viral, but when performed by someone else.
It was a horrible feeling. We woke up the day after Christmas, and somebody had tagged me in a Facebook video, and I saw this still image and realized I recognized this person, but it's not me. It was this person dressed exactly in my unique, what I thought was a unique bell suit. And I was fearful to even press a button and watch the video. And then when I did, my worst fears were confirmed, just seeing my entire routine verbatim played by somebody else.
The same song and everything.
Absolutely. The same song, same harmony, same choreography, absolutely verbatim.
And Kobe, people might think, this is just a YouTube video, no big deal. What does this mean to you as a performer?
Yeah, that was a hard thing to get people to understand. People think that it's just one person doing the video. But the bottom line is there's a couple different issues that go on. One is that so many people saw it that when we now perform it as part of our show, it's no longer necessarily seen as unique. And people will even say something like, oh, I saw that on YouTube. Or, yeah, you got that from that lady on YouTube. So I'm now being, she's being given credit for something that I created. People are thinking I'm imitating her. But then also because so many people saw it in the thousands of comments, there were just many references to, hey, this is great. We're going to do this in our show. We have to do this for this. Hey, let's put this in our act. So it's really this ripple effect that just keeps going, that it's much more than just one person performing the routine.
Now, Steve, let's bring you in. Now you're Kobe's partner on stage and in life, and you helped with the effort to try to get this under wraps. What did you do? How did you try to deal with this alternate version, this copied version of the performance?
Well, the thing about intellectual property infringement is you really have to enforce it. You have to find the people and you have to talk to them. And so I tracked down the person on Twitter and I said, hold on, this is our material and we haven't given you any rights to do this. And in response, the woman's daughter wrote back saying, we can do whatever you want with this. We were inspired by you and we're just going to keep going. And in fact, we're going to do more. So they had this idea that they were going to continue with the franchise and do more and more different songs as well. In the meantime, I tried to assert our rights to it, and the backlash that, well, I guess I shouldn't have been surprised, but pretty much everybody on Twitter, on her Twitter, told me to just sit down and shut up.
In very polite terms, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And did you reach out to Twitter, YouTube, any other operators of social media?
Yes, we wrote to Twitter and said, look, here's this routine, and we will show you a video of our routine. And they responded by taking down the other woman's video. So they found it to be an infringement of our copyright, of our intellectual property. Also, YouTube, it keeps popping up. It's like playing whack-a-mole.
Yeah, I saw it. I mean, it took me 2 seconds to find I don't know if it was the original offender, but someone else doing the same bit, yeah.
Yeah, right, right. So YouTube has taken it down every time I file a complaint against it.
Talking to Kobe Shaw and Steve Russell, they are jugglers and comedians based in Colfax, Wisconsin, talking about intellectual property on the internet, an act Kobe had done, among other places, on The Ellen Show, a copy of it online, lots of hits, gone viral. What do you do next when that happens? So on the internet, on YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, whatever, things become memes, and somebody does a thing and somebody else does a little different version of it. And that's kind of the way a lot of things travel along the internet, Kobe. How do you rein that in? How do you draw the line between a tribute and homage and theft?
I think we would have been less offended if perhaps she had taken the bell suit concept and had maybe played a different song. It still probably would have ruffled our feathers, but we wouldn't have found it as harsh as her doing the exact same routine. We're certainly not taking credit for, there have been variety of performers out there that have also worn jumpsuits with instruments on that. We're certainly not claiming that we came up with that. We've not seen something like the bells before. So it is difficult. We understand that finding original material is difficult, but to just blatantly take something, like I said, verbatim, is what really makes it difficult.
I should say that the woman was probably innocent who did this. She did it in her living room for her friends and family. And the only problem with it was that it went viral without their knowing it. And when I asked them to take it down, they absolutely refused. So the refusal is more the problem for us. And we certainly hope that other people don't copy what she did.
A lot of what you see on, say, YouTube is people covering famous songs. But is there a difference between if I went online and, I don't know, performed a Justin Bieber song, nobody's going to think I wrote that. I'm not going to create that impression. Whereas with something maybe not as well known, like your Bell's suit, Kobe, people won't instantly recognize that it's a cover version.
Exactly. Yes, people already know that, you know, Adele sings this song. They're not going to question that somebody else is getting credited for that. So that is a little bit more difficult being the little guy in that argument.
Well, Steve, as you mentioned, it's a game of whack-a-mole trying to catch all the versions. Is there a sense in which the genie is out of the bottle? Once it gets posted, not even the original performer, anybody else could keep reposting either their own versions or the first copy.
Yeah, it becomes a problem and an issue, and for us, protecting your rights in this realm all depends on how much time and how much money you have.
Mm-hmm.
So right now we have time. Money, I'm not so sure, but we do our best for this. We try to keep on top of it, because if we don't defend it, it will completely get out of our control.
There's been an issue in the news lately with comedians, and you do comedy as part of your regular act, and juggling and obviously the bell suit and things like that, but comedians in particular, and joke stealing or somebody posting a joke on Twitter that you might have heard a comedian do at a stand-up club. Is this something that worries you? Do you have to be careful as comedians that you're not accidentally stepping on someone else's material and that someone else isn't consciously borrowing your act? Kobe.
Yeah. We actually had an incident a couple years ago or back in our career. Steve came up with a routine while he was entertaining on cruise ships. When he got off the cruise ships, he discovered that somebody else at a parallel time had come up with the same routine.
Huh.
It was purely accidental, and it wasn't, certainly he had not seen this other person's routine. So that kind of stuff does happen, but it's when it's that intentional steal or that disregard. Like we said, we brought it to these people's attention that they were using somebody else's original material and they didn't care, nor did any of the other people that were watching it. They felt that this woman had a right and they didn't care who the original person was.
Well, Steve, I wonder, does this change the way you perform now? Are you reluctant maybe to have something that you do appear on TV? Do you keep people from videoing when you perform at events in hopes of keeping your shtick under wraps?
Well, the core of what we do is live performance. And we do go on TV occasionally, The Tonight Show and Ellen and Regis and Kelly and things like that. We've had that great fortune to do that, and it really bolsters our credibility. So that's part of what we do, and it's really hard to keep things under control. But we really do, before we go on these shows, we do say, is this going to be worth it to us? And we decide, well, yes, we are. We're going to do that. You know, we have been criticized, people in our own business saying, well, if you didn't want it to be stolen, you shouldn't have done it on national television. And I think that's kind of backwards, because it shouldn't be automatic that we should anticipate that it will be stolen, right? We should be able to do our work wherever we choose to do it and not have to worry about someone else taking it. It's not just automatic.
We'll leave it there for now. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Kobe, thanks to you.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Kobe Shaw and Steve Russell. They are Colfax-based comedians and jugglers. They perform as the company In Capable Hands. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. There's been an ongoing controversy over whether or not it's okay to have a drink or two during pregnancy, especially in the first few weeks before a woman may know that she's pregnant at all.
But last week, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released new guidelines on fetal alcohol syndrome. These guidelines recommend that sexually active women who aren't on birth control should not drink any alcohol at all. The organization says any alcohol at any stage of pregnancy could cause a range of disabilities for the child.
Dr. Cynthia Anderson is with us now to talk about these guidelines and to explain what fetal alcohol syndrome is. She's an OBGYN at UW Health. Dr. Anderson, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So what's changing with these new CDC drinking guidelines for women?
Well, the prior philosophy of the CDC really was more that women who are pregnant or who are actively trying to become pregnant should really avoid drinking alcohol because of the potential exposure to the fetus. And I think that what's new from the CDC guidelines is really that women who are sexually active with a male partner and who are not using reliable contraception should also just completely refrain from alcohol because the risk of an unintended pregnancy that could then expose the fetus to alcohol. So it's kind of a new layer to pre-existing guidelines.
And to talk about our terminology here, what is fetal alcohol syndrome and how does it affect babies?
Well, fetal alcohol syndrome is really the most severe form of a spectrum of disorders that's more broadly known as fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. So fetal alcohol syndrome, like I said, is the most severe form, and it has very specific diagnostic criteria that have been applied by the CDC, including growth delay, so low birth weight, less than the 10th percentile, very characteristic facial features and deformities, and also cognitive and motor problems that result from disorder in the central nervous system. But there's sort of a wider spectrum of disorders, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, that involve a range of mild to moderate symptoms that may not fully meet criteria for fetal alcohol syndrome.
And how many people are affected by fetal alcohol syndrome disorders?
Well, we don't know the full numbers because there's a lot of undiagnosed children out there, but the best CDC estimates are that up to 1 in 20 children may have some form of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder.
And what kind of treatment is there available?
Well, unfortunately, the results of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders last a lifetime. There's not really a cure per se, but we do know that early support and early diagnosis can improve a child's development. So usually there's a development of a comprehensive treatment plan with specialists in this field, and it may involve medications, behavioral therapy, support in educational environments, and also really close monitoring and follow-up over time.
So you're an OBGYN. How significant do you think that these new recommendations are for women?
Well, I think that it's promoting a conversation, which is much needed. 50% of births in the United States each year are unintended or unplanned. And so I think it's promoting a conversation with your healthcare provider about how to plan your pregnancy and how to plan the healthiest possible pregnancy.
So it's a conversation. These are recommendations. But if you're a woman of childbearing age, how seriously are you taking these?
Well, I think women, have a right to get all of the information that they need to make their own healthcare choices. I would take the recommendations pretty seriously. But, of course, the CDC can't ultimately control anybody's behavior. So it's going to be up to individual women to make decisions about what's best for them and their families.
We're talking right now with Dr. Cynthia Anderson from UW Health in Wisconsin, talking about new fetal alcohol syndrome guidelines that the CDC released last week. And there has been a little bit of backlash about these guidelines. Several sites with different opinions on this, the Washington Post, Jezebel, I believe, Slate. Here's a quote from one of them. Young women should avoid alcohol unless using birth control. The quote is that they're seeing babies as, or women as incubators for babies, and the government is just seeing all women as sort of in a state of pre-pregnancy. What do you think about that kind of backlash?
Well, I think that we should be careful when making these kinds of guidelines, because anything that we do that might make women, you know, feel ashamed or marginalized or, you know, feel that their decision-making is, you know, being preempted by some other government agency can sometimes lead to unnecessary consequences. Like women may be less likely to come in for care if they're feeling ashamed. They may be less likely to share important health information with their physician about their own health or maybe even about the health of their children. So I think these kind of guidelines need to be made in a way that makes sure women understand that they're being included in their healthcare decisions and they're not being marginalized.
So in the wider discussion here, some people have been pushing back that total abstinence just is maybe not realistic for women, and that women who may be of childbearing age may not be intending to get pregnant shouldn't have to abstain totally as the CDC recommends. What do you say to that?
I would say the more important discussion has to do with accessing reliable contraception. I think, you know, if you're planning to become pregnant, or certainly you're already pregnant, the safest thing to do is to avoid alcohol completely, because we do know that it has a pretty significant effect on fetal growth and development lifelong. But if you're sexually active with a male partner, you're not sterilized, your partner isn't sterilized, and you don't want to become pregnant, then the first discussion is, how do I get access to reliable contraception so that I don't have a pregnancy that wasn't intended? And I think the discussion about fetal alcohol syndrome and the risks of that are another layer of that conversation.
So where does that conversation about birth control take us? How reliable and how available is birth control right now?
I think it's getting better. We definitely still have women who can't access the services that they need, and that's unfortunate. We also have men who can't access the services that they need. But the Affordable Care Act has made some definite moves in the right direction to guarantee contraceptive coverage for all women who want it. And we also have some newer methods of contraception that are quite a bit more effective, like IUDs and subdermal implants that don't rely on having to remember taking a pill every day. They're 20 times less likely to result in an unwanted pregnancy compared to the older methods. So I think that we're making strides in terms of making contraception better and more effective and more available, but we're certainly not there yet. And unfortunately, we still live in a society where the majority of responsibility for family planning falls on women. And I think, you know, we need to be making better strides in the healthcare sector to find methods that are available to men as well.
Do you think that the federal government has done enough to ensure access to birth control? Should emphasis be placed there right now instead of maybe looking at this end of it?
I think that they've made some strides in the right direction. I mean, there are some statewide initiatives in Colorado, for instance, that showed great impact on reducing teen pregnancy rates, reducing unintended pregnancy rates, and even reducing abortion rates when they made comprehensive contraception available to all women, especially with the newer, more long-acting methods. And models from that state, like the state of Colorado, I think could be disseminated to other states, and that I think holds great promise.
Is there any move to do that, to take that Colorado model and transplant it?
They are trying to do that, but it's costly, and there's a lot of you know, logistical barriers in terms of funding and such.
I want to look back at maybe a little bit of the science behind alcohol use during pregnancy. Now, anyone who's been pregnant knows that, you know, there's lots of theories floating around there. You often hear things like, well, in Europe, Italian doctors say you can have a couple glasses of wine. I know someone who said their doctor said it was fine. So what is the science on how damaging alcohol is during pregnancy?
Well, you know, even Hal Lawrence, who's CEO of the American College of OBGYN, who was just quoted in an article about this, said, you know, for many years, the standard guidance from your physician was if you had a drink or two maybe in the first trimester before you knew you were pregnant, it was probably fine and nothing to worry about. And I think in many ways that's still the standard party line, but I think we're starting to understand more that especially during critical periods of fetal development, like between the third and the ninth week of gestation when all the major organs are forming, the heart, the kidneys, the ears, and major nervous system development of the brain and spinal cord are occurring not only through the first trimester but throughout the rest of pregnancy as well, alcohol really has an impact on all of the development of those major organs. And so, you know, the best and safest thing to do, according to all the professional associations now, really is to avoid all alcohol consumption during pregnancy, that there's really no known amount of alcohol that we can say is definitely safe.
We're talking right now with Dr. Cynthia Anderson about the new fetal alcohol syndrome guidelines that the CDC released last week.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about these new guidelines that say if you are a sexually active woman, you should, unless you're using birth control, abstain completely from alcohol? Is it realistic to expect these women who aren't on birth control to stop drinking completely? And what was your experience maybe during your own pregnancy? Did you try to abstain? Did you abstain completely from alcohol? If you're a healthcare provider, what do you tell your patients? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion now with Dr. Cynthia Anderson from UW Health, talking about fetal alcohol syndrome and new CDC guidelines for women.
Taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Our guest says the growing state of the art says women shouldn't drink, especially at critical stages during pregnancy. These new CDC guidelines say not even when you're pregnant, before you're pregnant. If you are of childbearing age, you're sexually active, you're not using birth control, no booze for you is their recommendation. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these guidelines from the CDC? I don't think they go too far or a good idea. What do you think should be done to help avoid fetal alcohol syndrome, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders? Have you had to deal with one of those problems in your own life, in your own health practice, and in your own experience? Something people don't always want to talk about, but what was your attitude toward drinking during pregnancy? If you're in the current generation or generations past, the Mad Men era, what did you do then? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take a caller now. We've got Andrea on the line from Menominee. Andrea, hi.
Hi. I'm calling because this is personally affects me. I'm 10 weeks into an unplanned pregnancy, and I drank for the first 2 weeks prior to finding out that I was pregnant. And I feel like pregnant women already have so many things we have to be afraid about. And then this is just another thing to have to worry about.
Right. Andrew, thank you so much for your comment. And that's something that has been echoed online, that it's a scary time, it seems like, in some ways, to be pregnant. It seems like there's a lot to worry about. And now these new CDC guidelines, as you said, Dr. Anderson, adding another layer to that conversation. What do you think about sort of the fear factor in all of this, and especially drinking during those first couple of weeks, like Andrea was mentioning?
Yeah, I completely understand what Andrea is referring to. We have a lot of patients who express those same kind of fears. And I think that's one of the reasons why the CDC and other professional organizations have to be really careful about the kind of messaging, because, you know, pregnancy can be a time when, you know, women are making a lot of changes in their own lives, a lot of health changes and behavior changes to accommodate a new pregnancy. And, you know, fear and such doesn't really help. So I think, you know, we need to give women practical strategies for how to deal with this. And I think an important thing for Andrea and other women going through that same circumstance would be to just talk to your doctor, make sure that they understand if there's any additional testing that's warranted, that you can, you know, get the care that you need. And I think in the future, the conversation, like I mentioned earlier, would be better around contraception for those women who need it and want it.
Andrea, thank you so much for your comment. And you can join us at 800-642-1234. What do you think about these new guidelines? If a woman is sexually active with a male partner, not on birth control, she should be abstaining completely. Is that something that you will do now that these guidelines are in hand? Do you think that the contraceptives available are adequate? And what would you like to see changed to support women in this? Call 800-642-1234. And we have a comment here from Kelly on Facebook who says that the guidelines are supported by science, but the CDC's failure to communicate that effectively threatens its efforts to educate women of childbearing age. What would you say to that, Dr. Anderson?
Yeah, I mean, the science is there. We know that fetal alcohol spectrum disorders are real and that they impact a lot of children. But again, we need to make sure that the messaging that comes out to women promotes a collaborative environment with their healthcare providers, and that it promotes open discussion, and that it doesn't in any way make women feel afraid or ashamed or marginalized in terms of making their own healthcare decisions. So I think that was the unfortunate thing that happened after the CDC guideline came out, is that a lot of women sort of took offense to the way that the messaging was delivered. And I think that's what a lot of the backlash was that we read about over the weekend and even into today. So I think that's a cautionary tale that we need to take away as healthcare providers, that even with good science, we need to make sure that we're communicating in a way that promotes effective healthcare relationships.
Now, looking strictly here at Wisconsin, Wisconsin has a reputation for being a high alcohol use state and alcohol abuse as well. Does Wisconsin have a higher instance of these fetal alcohol syndrome disorders?
You know, that is a great question, and I would have to talk to some of my colleagues. There are specialists in, developmental pediatrics who deal with the children that are affected. And as an OBGYN, I don't really care for the children. So I would need to talk with them about that. I certainly know that in the state of Wisconsin, we have very high rates of drinking in general. We have very high rates of binge drinking, and also high rates of binge drinking among young women of reproductive age, so between the ages of 14 and 45. So I would anticipate that we probably are more affected than some of the other states that have much lower rates of drinking in general and lower rates of binge drinking.
We're going to go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Jane on the line in Kaukauna. Jane, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share?
I'm just wondering about in the 1950s and 40s, and again, like the caller just said, it's from Wisconsin, drinking was kind of the norm. It was all part of going out with their friends. What happened to all of those fetal alcohol syndrome who are now adults? Did they see a lot of this? And I guess I'm just curious.
Great. Jane, thank you so much for that question. She's saying, looking back at the 60s, drinking was a big part of culture. So do we have any sort of data about what happened with those babies who may have been on that spectrum disorder that you're talking about?
Yeah, I don't think that we have great data on kind of people that are currently adults. Fetal alcohol syndrome in its most severe form has been pretty well understood, and there are specific diagnostic criteria that have been widely accepted and used. But that doesn't account for the majority of cases now, and the milder to more moderate forms of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders are only now really coming to be recognized. So I don't know the numbers on that.
So looking back, there's not clear markers of a kind of public health crisis, a generation that was marked by this.
Well, we know that rates of drinking are rising and rates of binge drinking are rising as well. So I think that is one of the reasons why the CDC is starting to look into this more.
We're talking right now with Dr. Cynthia Anderson from UW Health. She's an OBGYN, and we're talking about new guidelines on fetal alcohol syndrome that the CDC released last week. And you mentioned that you thought one direction the CDC could begin to look was in more research on contraceptives for men. What sorts of things are you thinking about there?
Well, you know, the only real contraceptive method that we have for men these days would be either vasectomy, which is a permanent form of sterilization, or condoms. And, you know, vasectomy is not widely used in the United States. Condoms are more widely used, and they're the best method that we have, certainly for prevention of sexually transmitted infections, but they're not the best method that we have for family planning and birth control. We have a lot of other methods that are much better in terms of birth control, but all those other methods are for women. So there's definitely some research going on to try to look at forms of male contraception to really include men in the discussion and also in the family planning efforts, but I think we're not there yet.
And Dr. Anderson, we're just about out of time, about 30 seconds here. What is your message for your patients? What do you tell them about how they should behave around alcohol?
Well, moderation really is key. You know, we know that drinking in moderation, you know, 6 or 7 drinks in a week is really the most that's recommended in terms of health and safety. And binge drinking really should be avoided. And so I would say that it's important to, you know, keep in touch with your healthcare provider, not only about the amount of alcohol that you're consuming, but about whether or not you're sexually active with a male partner. And if you are, whether or not you would like to become pregnant or not. And if you are, you know, planning to become pregnant and you're actively trying to become pregnant, then the best and safest thing to do is really to stop drinking alcohol at all. If you're
And we leave it there. Dr. Anderson, I'm sorry, but thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Dr. Cynthia Anderson, OBGYN at UW Health, joining us to talk about new guidelines on fetal alcohol spectrum disorders that were just released by the CDC last week.
How smart is your dog? Every dog owner knows the answer to that question. They are the cleverest little puppy. Yes, they are.
But researchers in the United Kingdom are trying to put a more objective measure on that question. In a paper published in the journal Intelligence, scientists say they've developed an IQ test for dogs with tests like finding a hidden food, responding to a human pointing, and judging which plate a food has more on it.
I could nail this test, by the way. But one conclusion, there is a difference in general intelligence from one dog to the next. A dog who's good at one test tends to be better on the other tests. And they're hoping for some insight, they say, not just into canine intelligence, but some lessons for us humans as well. Because one bonus of studying dogs, you don't have to worry about, you know, smoking or alcohol or other health variables that can mess things up.
Now, the research team that worked on this, they used border collies who worked on farms. So it does not, by the way, answer the question of whether one breed is smarter than another breed.
And I wonder if this is something people want to know. Do they want to know if their individual dog is particularly smart or non-smart, or if one breed is smarter than another? Do I want a dog that's smarter than the other dog? Do I risk having a dog that's smarter than me? Would you want to know? You're eventually going to get a dog, I think.
I think so. I think all dog owners would want to know this, right?
Okay.
It's a way of better understanding your dog. And then, of course, you get the extra bonus of having bragging rights at the dog park. You'd be like, my dog has a 53. Your dog looks like about a 24.
Yeah, so this would be some horrible status symbol of dog ownership.
Yeah, maybe we shouldn't do it after
Maybe not. Some things people weren't meant to know. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.